Welcome to Author Stories, the podcast where we talk to the best writers in the industry and discuss writing and the creative process. Whether you are a writer, a reader, or both, we hope you'll find something here that makes you love books and the writers that create them. You can find archives of all of the great conversations I've had with authors over the years at hankgarner.com. Take some time and browse around there. I'm sure you'll find a new author to love, find inspiration for your own creative life, and find a new story to get lost in. Let's thank some sponsors who make the show possible. No Good Deed, book one of the Mark Taylor psychological thriller series by M.P. McDonald, is free on Amazon.com. Seeing the future comes at a price. What price would you be willing to pay to save thousands of lives? Mark Taylor knows his actions scream guilty, but he was only trying to stop the horrible terrorist attack. Instead of a thank you, the government labels him an enemy combatant and throws him in the brig with no rights, no trial, and no way to prove his innocence. He learns firsthand that the CIA can do anything they want to him, anything at all. Mark's just a regular guy, a photographer, who finds himself in an extraordinary situation when an antique camera he buys at a dusty Afghanistan bazaar produces photographs of future tragedies, tragedies he's driven to prevent. His frantic warnings about September 11th are ignored, but put him in the government crosshairs when he learns what being labeled an enemy combatant really means. Download this intense and gripping thriller now, free on Amazon. No Good Deed, book one of the Mark Taylor psychological thriller series by M.P. McDonald. As the Crow Flies, Enter Haddon Wood, book one by Risa Walker and Caleb Ansell. From Risa Walker, the award-winning author of the best-selling Kronos Files, and debut author Caleb Ansell, comes a chilling story of altered reality and psychological terror. Chase Ray sits perfectly still, his thumbs traveling across the screen of the broken computer tablet, stuck in the nexus between two worlds. Haddon Wood isn't real. It can't be. Another world, another reality, hovers just beyond his reach. He can see it sometimes. He can almost touch it. In that world, things are in balance. The dead stay dead and the creature feature remains safely on the screen. That world isn't a patchwork quilt of every scary book or movie he's seen. In that world, the nightmares generally end when you open your eyes and people don't glitch in and out of existence. Chase is determined to return to that world, although he's a bit worried that the only way out is through the noose that seems to lurk around every corner. He needs allies to get back home. But how do you choose your team when you can't tell who's real? As the Crow Flies, Enter Haddon Wood, Book 1 by Risa Walker and Caleb Ansell. We're so happy to have our friend Crystal Pico Watanabe as a sponsor of the show. Crystal is one of the best editors in the business, and she has just debuted a new service that I think you'll absolutely love and will help you to up your writing game. Pico's School of Wordcraft and Editing has just debuted, and the first course is called Properly Punctuating Dialogue. It's a mini course and can be completed in just about 20 minutes. It covers the basics of dialogue punctuation. Authors can get access to the new school and the course for free by signing up for Crystal's author newsletter, Notes from Pico. Go to picoshouse.com/newsletters, that's PIKKOSHOUSE.com/newsletters. More in-depth courses will be added in 2020. Make sure you don't miss a thing. picoshouse.com/newsletters. Unwilling Souls by Gregory D. Little. Books 1 and 2 are only 99 cents for a limited time. The gods are rightfully imprisoned, and Cess intends to keep them that way. But her terrorist father has other plans. Gregory D. Little's Unwilling Souls is a pulse-pounding chase through an epic fantasy world of adventure, sinister conspiracy, and a magical industrial revolution fueled by harvested human souls. Cess is the daughter of powerful parents who would very much like to kill one another and who therefore pretends she doesn't exist. An apprentice jailer of the gods, Cess spends her days learning to forge the tools needed to maintain the gods' prison. When her terrorist father attacks the prison on her 16th birthday, Cess is forced to flee after the secret of her parentage is revealed. Suddenly on the wrong side of the law, Cess realizes the very father who abandoned her may be the only one who can protect her. But some secrets are darker than parentage. On her way to find her father, Cess will uncover truths about her family and herself that will shatter her understanding of the world and risk the return of the gods themselves. Unwilling Souls and its sequel, Ungrateful God, are on sale now for only 99 cents. The third book of the series is coming early next year, so now is the perfect time to get up to speed. Unwilling Souls by Gregory D. Little. Books 1 and 2, only 99 cents for a limited time. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm really excited to have Bernard Cornwell returning to the show after about 600 episodes or so to talk about his brand new book, Sword of Kings. This is the 12th book, if you can believe it, in the Saxon Tales series. Welcome back to the show, Mr. Cornwell.
Well, thank you. Good to be back.
I'm excited to have you. Last time we got to kind of a bird's eye view of your writing career and all of the adventures that you've had along the way. I can't believe that we're up to book 12 of the Saxon Tales. Did you ever imagine when you first started, you know, thinking about writing about the history of England that there was so much story to tell?
I think there's far more than 12.
Well, in this particular vein.
I'm rather glad to have got those years down to just 12 books. And these books are about the making of England. I mean, right. The English are very weird. They have no idea where their country came from. So it's telling that story.
Right. It's really strange, as being an American with familial English ties. Most of my family are from England and Scotland and Wales and Ireland. But I'm very much American. You don't have that experience, that connection to my ancestry. But, you know, being from a country that is, you know, some of the oldest things you can find in America that are American are, you know, 300-400 years tops. But when you think about a society like England and Britain, you know, we from here think of that as an ancient place and people. Yet most of the history, when you start looking at the history of England, it almost begins at 1066 for most of the time.
Well, that's the way it's thought.
Right.
And usually when you learn history in an English school, as I did, you know, you touch on the Romans, you very briefly mention King Alfred, that he was a very bad baker, and then you cut straight to 1066. But obviously the history goes back way, way beyond that. And England itself was created just over 1,000 years ago. Before that, there were four kingdoms, Wessex, Mercia, East Anglia, and Northumbria. And they were quite independent kingdoms. At one time, there were seven kingdoms. And the story is how those four kingdoms united to become one country called England. And it's a very violent tale in which the Vikings play a very large part. So, you know, that's the story. And with Sword of Kings, we're getting towards the end of the making of England, but we're not quite there yet.
When you start attempting to tackle a subject like this, where do you begin? And I know we've kind of tied this together in the character of Uhtred, but were you looking for a character who could kind of be the personification of this unity and this birth?
Well, I was looking for a story. I mean, most historical novels, think about Gone with the Wind. You have a very big story. The big story is the Civil War, who is going to win it. The little story is can Scarlet save Tara? And you know, the little story is entirely fictional. But that goes in the foreground, and the big story goes in the background. But I don't know quite when this began. I guess it began way back at university when I read lots and lots of Anglo-Saxon poetry and rather liked it. And that started an interest in that period. But as it were, the spark didn't set fire to it until, gosh, I don't know, 20 years ago, when I met my real birth father for the very first time. He was Canadian and living in Victoria. And he showed me the family tree. And the family tree went all the way back to the 6th century. to a wonderful man called Ida the Flame Bearer. And he was a, I'll call him a Saxon, he was properly an Angle, which is the same thing really. And he captured a great fortress on the Northumbrian coast, which was named Bebbanburg by his son. And it's still there, only now it's called Bamburgh Castle. And to my astonishment, my family had been the lords of Bebbanburg for some 400 years. And I thought, how did they keep their land when all around them the country had been invaded by Danes and by Vikings? And they did keep it. And so I thought, that's my story. My story is the story of a real ancestor of mine, though I've basically just taken his name and invented the rest, on how he kept his land on the wild Northumbrian coast.
The Danes and the Vikings, Vikings especially, really play you know, an integral part in this story that you're telling. Were there things that surprised you that as you started writing the series and digging into the history that, you know, that certain people are just tragically misrepresented in our idea of history?
Oh, I don't know if they're tragically misrepresented. I mean, the Vikings are incredibly romantic. Much of that goes back to the two opera designers of the 19th century who invented the horns on the helmet idea.
A dumb
idea. If you think about it, it is
an
incredibly dumb idea. If you're in battle, someone can knock your helmet off rather easily. But no, the Vikings invaded, let's say, half of what is now England. And Vikings is a very loose word. I mean, it's maybe better to say they were Scandinavians. And they did the same on the western coast of Scotland and again in much of Ireland. They very nearly took the whole lot, Britain and Ireland, a lot. So the creation of England really is a story of fighting against these invaders. But they were never thrown out. They simply were assimilated. And they became part of the English population. They learned to speak English. They married among the Saxons. And they gave us an enormous number of their words. Skirt, skull, all sorts of words. Egg come from the Vikings. They don't come from the English language. So still to this day, lots and lots of towns in northern and eastern England have Scandinavian names. They don't sound Scandinavian to us because we're so used to them. But almost anywhere which ends Ness or Thorpe is a Scandinavian settlement. So in the end, the Vikings simply melt into the population.
Why do you think we romanticize the idea of the Viking? Is it because of those set designers and in the opera? You know, the actual history is not nearly as kind of over the top as.
Well, they were extraordinary when you think right. What they did. I mean, they came out of Scandinavia. It was James Joyce who termed the wonderful word Scandinavery. But from what is often very bad land in Norway, Sweden, less so perhaps in Denmark, they spread across not just the sort of known world at the time, but right across the Atlantic. They settled Iceland, Greenland. We know they settled in Newfoundland. They went up the rivers deep into Russia and settled Russia. They went all the way down to the Mediterranean. They were an extraordinary people. And they had those wonderful boats, the longships, which again are very romantic. So yes, they are an extraordinary race, absolutely extraordinary. And I think, you know, it's good to be interested in them because they made a lot of what is now Europe.
Right. The early in the series, we see this melding of the Viking culture and the what will become English culture in. You know, in the adoption, or you know, we have a character who is adopted by the Vikings, and then wants to get back to his homeland and reconnect with who he is.
He's a very confused character. He doesn't know if he's English or Danish, Christian or pagan.
Right, which brings me to something I've been thinking about: the idea of religion and nationality, or you know, religion and culture, because the you know, the Christian, you know, England, or as it would become, was dominated by Christianity, and then the pagan Vikings. When you're working on those things, how do those the religion, how does that play into what makes them uniquely them?
Well, it plays very, very deeply into it. I mean, the story of the making of England begins with Alfred, who we call Alfred the Great. And he undoubtedly was a very great king. And he is king of Wessex, which is right at the bottom of England. And during his reign, the Vikings very nearly capture Wessex, very nearly. But he fights back. He wins an extraordinary victory at a place called Edington. And from then on, it's sort of Saxon victory after Saxon victory. They gradually work their way north under Alfred, his son, his daughter, and his grandson. But what made the war perhaps even more violent was the fact that Alfred and his successors were all Christian and very pious Christians. Alfred was an extraordinarily religious man, was very good to the church, and his dream was to have a Christian England. Now, if a Viking chieftain or a Viking king converted to Christianity, in Alfred's eyes, he was no longer the enemy. He could simply be assimilated into the growing country. But if they insisted on keeping their paganism, they were an enemy. And that enmity was made much worse by this religious fervor. And I think it's fair to say that Christianity was part of the driving force of the unification of England. And it worked. I mean, at the end, the pagans were driven out. In the end, of course, the Vikings themselves converted when missionaries went to Scandinavia. But for this period, they're still pagan.
Another great legend that plays into our idea of history, whether it's how seriously we take it, is up for grabs. But the idea of Arthur and that the first Christian king, and all of the legends that have been changed and romanticized and all that, especially by the French, the story changes and changes. But as you go through this history and writing the series, do those legends come up, and how much of those can be anchored in reality?
Well, in a sense, those legends are slightly different. The Arthurian stories are probably anchored in the immediate post-Roman period. So we're talking, in the 5th and 6th centuries. And we're now, the story I'm writing is set in the 9th and 10th centuries. And yeah, they knew those stories. They did know those stories. They had no idea where they came from. Because King Arthur, if indeed he was a king, and I suspect he probably was not, but never mind, he is a Briton. And we would now call them the Welsh. His language was what is now Welsh. And what he was fighting a Saxon invasion. And they hated the Saxons. The Saxons at that time were pagan, if you like. It's exactly the same story as the one I'm telling, but it has a different ending. And what those stories are about, really, is the British resistance to what became the English invasion. And if King Arthur existed, or if a character called Arthur existed, it's very likely that he won an enormous victory at a place called Mount Badon. And that's what made him famous. And then what happened after that, and this is sort of rather curious, is that the Saxons themselves take on this character. And instead of being a Welsh warlord, he becomes this very Christian English king. And we still sort of see him in that way. As a great English king. He's not. He's a great Welsh warlord. But this new battle is against a different enemy, so I don't think that legend has quite as much relevance as it will come to have later.
You talked about this this family, this ancestor of yours, and wanting to kind of build the story around a very personal story, that someone who's attempting to protect his land and his life and his family. When you're So the story is in the beginning is very character driven, and I think still is. But you're dealing with real, actual historical facts that surround the story, which would, you know, would make you think that, well, this must be plot driven because you've got to steer it toward certain things that happened. But this is very much character driven. Can you talk a little bit about balancing those two, the characters that you make up versus the real world happenings?
Well, it's storytelling against history versus history, isn't it? And I mean, that's something I think all historical novelists do. And if we go back to Gone with the Wind, you know, the characters are what really capture us and make us want to find out what happens. Well, what I've done is I've taken this character who did actually exist, but he certainly didn't do the things that I make him do because we don't know what he did. There's simply not enough records. Historians hate the phrase the Dark Ages, but in some ways, this is a dark age. The chronicles, the various chronicles, are either written too late or they don't tell us enough. So there's an enormous amount that we don't know. Well, that's great for me because I'm a novelist, so I can make it up. But in the end, I'm sure the character that I'm writing about didn't live as long as I'm making him live. But simply because I wanted him to be there right through the whole creation, right from the beginning when the Danes almost capture Wessex to the ending when the Saxons beat back the Danes, the Vikings, the Scots, everybody. And suddenly there is this country, which they wanted to make, and they now have finally made it. They called it Ingleland, and we now call it England. So yes, that story is in the background all the time. But I'm not that concerned about getting the historical facts absolutely right, simply because we don't know most of the historical facts. What I'm concerned about is telling a story about one family and its struggle to keep their land. And I keep saying to people, look, I'm not an historian. I'm a storyteller. That's my job. That's what I do every day. I tell stories. It's a wonderful way to earn a living.
Absolutely. You say you're not an historian, but a storyteller, but I'm very sure that you have a lot of readers who either are historians or kind of armchair historians, like a lot of us like to be. Do you ever get challenged from readers on the license that you take with the story?
Very, very rarely. It's usually over specifics. I wrote a trilogy about Arthur. And got a very indignant letter saying, you have snowdrops in Britain in the 6th century. There were no snowdrops. Well, fine, you know, I mean, I'm going to believe the man. And actually, I got far more challenges over the Arthur stories, but most of them, and I can't even tell you how many. I think I wrote them before I'd sort of got an email account. So they came in snail mail. And I must have received close to 100 letters that all began the same way, saying, dear Mr. Cornwell, I just read your book, The Winter King, and I have to tell you, you've got it all wrong. I was Guinevere in a previous existence. And you can't argue with that. You know, I mean, terrific. I counted them the other day, 17 letters claiming to have been Guinevere, which is great, you know. I mean, an interesting woman.
Yeah, for sure. There's nothing to argue there. Just thank you.
There's nothing to argue. you just write back and say thank you. I'll try and talk to you the next time I do a book like this. Nobody ever writes and says that they were a warrior in Alfred's army or they were a Viking. But having said that, I'll probably start getting a whole lot of emails soon.
That's so funny. When you first came to America, we talked last time about that you had a little time on your hands as you were trying to get settled, and you decided to write a book to pass the time.
Well, it was even worse than that. It was far worse than that. I mean, I had very sensibly fallen in love with a wonderful woman. We're still married 40 years later. She was from Pennsylvania, and I couldn't get a green card. I mean, I was literally couldn't work. So I said, don't worry, darling, I'll write a book. Now, I mean, looking back on it, it was completely insane. But it sort of worked. We're still married and I'm still writing.
That book, you know, launched the character of Sharps that we all, you know, love, as well as this series. When that series began, which is grounded in the Napoleonic Wars, that is a little, you know, farther in the future, or farther future into the past, closer to we are now than the series. Are there differences in the way you approach those characters and stories? Because there is more known about the Napoleonic period.
Well, yes. I mean, the nice thing about writing about the Napoleonic period is that we have an immense amount of material, research material. I mean, not just great historians have written about it, but the letters that the people themselves wrote. And if you want to know about how society behaved, we've got Jane Austen's novels. We have an enormous amount of material, diaries, letters, newspapers, history books. I mean, it's wonderful. The nice thing about writing about what I shouldn't call, but will call, the Dark Ages, is that there's so much is unknown, so much is in shadow, that it's an opportunity to make it up. You can't make up a lot of things about the Napoleonic Wars without really upsetting people who know a lot about it. So you have to sort of cleave quite tightly to the real history, but not in the Saxon period.
Do those books start to take shape differently if you're writing a Sharp book versus, you know, one of the Saxon tales? Is there more planning in one than the other?
Oh, gosh, I wish I could plan a book. I've never been able to plan a book, ever. That would make my life so easy. I think it was Somerset Maugham who said there are three rules for writing a novel. Unfortunately, no one knows what they are. I mean, some writers, I mean, famously Joanne Rowling, can plan not just a book, but a series way ahead. And I've met other writers who can do that. And equally, I know a lot of writers who, like me, simply have no idea. You start the book off and see what happens. And that sounds weird, but it works. Well, it works for me. And I mean, when I got to the last chapter of Sword of Kings, I wasn't entirely sure how it was going to end. I mean, right now I'm on chapter 4 of the book after that. I'm looking at it now on my screen. And one character just said, "So what are we doing here?" And the hero says, "I don't know." And that's entirely true. I haven't a clue.
I love it. Well, you know, that's the main argument that you hear from people that are planners, is that if you don't plan ahead of time, then each day when you sit down to work, you don't know what you're going to do, and there's a lot of wasted time that goes in that.
But think of the joy of discovering.
Exactly.
I mean, what's the joy of reading a great novel? The joy of reading a novel is to find out what happens. And every day I sit down and I find out what happens next, and it's wonderful. And yes, you do. There is some wasted time. But, I mean, the truth to tell, I think all writers, including those who plan, probably waste a lot of time.
Oh, of course.
You know, staring out the window, wondering whether accountancy would be a better career, all those things.
Well, you have proven, you know, that dictum to not necessarily be true, because you are very prolific with your writing and have even kind of bumped up against the publishing industry, you know, when people told you that that no one wants to hear from an author more than once a year.
That was years and years ago. And that was in Britain. That was in Britain, not here. But I used to write 2 books a year, but I've slowed down. I'm getting old now. It's time to relax.
Very well. Are there any tricks or tools that you've used over the years that help you to keep the story flowing?
Lord above, I wish I could. I wish I could give some, you know, a proper answer to that. The answer is absolutely no. I mean, I'm not quite sure how many books I've written. I know it's more than 50. And every time I start one, I think I can't do this. But you know, you kick it off, put something down on page one, and the wonderful thing is that the characters, to an extent, take over. They tell you what they want to do, and sometimes you have to whip them into shape and say, "No, you can't do that." I really don't know. I mean, obviously, I enjoy doing it, and I can't imagine any writer doesn't enjoy it. If they don't enjoy it, then they shouldn't be doing it. But No, I honestly don't. I haven't got any tips at all, except just sit down every day and do it.
Right. Do you have a daily writing habit, or are you kind of on project and then have a different daily routine when you're off project?
I'm sort of beginning to take the summers off, so this, my summers are wonderfully relaxed, and I sort of start the books in September and finish them around April. But when I'm actually writing, it's more or less the same every day. Get up, take the dog for a walk, work for 3 or 4 hours, take the dog for another walk, work for another, you know, like that, all day. I simply don't believe in the idea of writer's block, which is a... It might apply to somebody who's never written before or is writing their first or second book, because they simply don't have the confidence that what they're doing will find a publisher or any readers at all. So, yes, I understand that. And maybe it applies to these really, really wonderfully clever writers who write about the nuances of the human soul, and I don't do that either. It's a job. And I'll believe in writer's block the day that a nurse can phone a hospital and say, I can't come in today, I've got nurse's block. And the hospital says, oh, no, dear, you mustn't. No, no, stay home. We'll pay you. Just stay home. Don't come. Come in when you feel better. I mean, a nurse's job is far more difficult than mine. Far more taxing, far more demanding, far more stressful. And yet we don't accord them the privilege of nurse's block. And yet writers seem to be given this privilege, and if you're not feeling up to it, then it's okay, you just wait for it to come back. It isn't like that. It's a job. It's a wonderful job. It's a terrific job. And you simply have to do it every day.
Right. You have lived in the United States for a few decades now. And
40 years.
40 years, wow. And all of your stories, with the exception, I believe, of the book that you wrote about the American Civil War, are English historical fiction. Is it different writing about those places and times from over here? And do you get a different perspective, or is it all just make-believe?
That's an interesting question. I mean, it's interesting that, I mean, C.S. Forrester, who wrote the wonderful Hornblower books, he wrote them all in California, you know, about his great English naval hero. P.G. Woodhouse, who surely wrote the most English books ever, wrote them all in Long Island. I don't find it any kind of a drawback. I love living here. I would never, never go home again, I mean, back again. I suppose that, what was it that it was Hartley who said, the past is a different country. So I don't think you have to live in England to write about England any more than you have to live in the USA to write about the USA. And I think, guess I write about it because I grew up there. My education was English. The countryside I learned first was English. The voices I hear in my head tend to be the voices of the first 35 years of my life. And I know that history well. So I never really think about it at all. I guess you could say that inside this office where I am, it is England.
Does it help to go back and visit and stand on English soil and look at the English sky? Does that...
No. I mean, honestly, the skies are much the same. Maybe more dramatic here. It helps to go to the event, if you like, that made England. Was a battle called the Battle of Brunanburg, which no one's ever heard of, and that's fine. There's no reason why anybody should have heard of it. But it was fought in the year 937, and for centuries afterwards, it was called the Great Battle or the Great War, and it was an enormous Saxon victory. And strangely, people forgot where it was fought, and there's been huge arguments for the last couple of hundred years about where Brunanburg is. Well, magnificently and wonderfully, some archaeologists have found it, literally in the last couple of years. And so, well, 2 weeks ago, I went over to look at it. Now, that's going to be the ending of the book I'm writing now. And that helps enormously, to have been there, seen what the countryside looked like, try to work out what it would have looked like 1,000 years ago, which isn't as difficult as it sounds, talking to archaeologists. That sort of thing is invaluable. In other words, to see a specific place, but not just the general atmosphere. I mean, I got plenty of that in my first 35 years. But you do have to go and see specific places which you're going to write about. So that I do that.
Yeah. In those 40 years that you've been here in the States, I know you began writing that first Sharp book around that same time. So you've been writing novels for the better part of 40 years. And I know you were at the BBC before that, and there's doing a different type of storytelling, but storytelling still the same. How have the tools of writing changed in that amount of time? I heard you say recently in an interview that you love having a large monitor where you can put two pages up at the same time. that is definitely, you know, a luxury of, you know, living in the 20-teens. 40 years ago, what was the writing like? And do you feel like the advancement of the tools that we use, has that changed writing or your writing in any way?
Well, frankly, it's made it easier. It has made it easier. But I mean, I know that there are some writers who do it all longhand to this day. I've known two or three who write all their books in longhand and then give it to a typist. I was a journalist with the BBC for 10 years, and there was no way that I was going to do that longhand. You know, I was used to typing. And so when I wrote the first book, it was all on an electric typewriter. And then, you know, came the sort of huge break of going into word processing and computers. And it's made it easier. I mean, the honest truth is it's made it easier, at least for me. But, you know, remember, there are three rules and we don't know what they are. And for some people, the only way to do it is to still to pen and ink and write it all out by hand. I mean, I'm, as you say, extremely fortunate. I have a 42-inch monitor and you can see two pages at once. It's great. Oh, I do find that I rewrite more when you're looking at two pages like that, because you can see when your sort of thoughts are wandering about what shall I do next, your eyes wander across and think, well, that sentence is no good, let's change that. So I think computers have made it much easier, but there are lots of writers who would disagree and some who would never have a computer in the house.
Right. Well, I know that because I'm old enough to have used typewriters early on, but the computer revolution was well in hand by the time I really started. But it seems to me that folks that write on a typewriter, you might be more careful, maybe more thoughtful before putting words down. Is that true? And do you think computers help us to be more revisionist?
I mean, that's what they say about writing it longhand, that it forces, you know, that your hand can't move any faster than your thoughts. I'm really not sure. I think because the computer makes the rewriting so easy, that you know, maybe the thought is spread out over a longer period of time, because you're going to, I know when I typed a book out, I probably would only rewrite it once or twice. Now I probably rewrite anything up to a dozen times in the same amount of time. So, you know, it's swings and roundabouts. It's whatever works for you best.
Sure. Modern readers have a lot of things vying for their attention. There's social media and people are constantly looking at their phones and getting updates there, and YouTube and Netflix, and there are lots of things vying for people's immediate attention. And publishing has changed a lot over these years, as we, you know, ebooks and things like that have really changed the landscape. How do you feel about the state of publishing now versus 40 years ago? Do you think we're heading in a good direction? What do you think about the
technology? Well, we're heading in an inevitable direction. Whether it's good or bad, we have to live with it. I mean, certainly publishing, I've had the same publisher for 40 years, and they've been very good to me and for me. I mean, what I'm noticing immediately is that audiobook sales are going up very fast. Obviously, e-books are increasing. But there are still people who want to have the physical book. Storytelling is, you know, the second oldest profession. And all sorts of things on social media and television, cinema, publishing need stories. So, you know, I still go back to thinking of myself as a storyteller, and that somewhere, somehow, we're going to find a way of selling that story. But I think people are reading as much as ever, even if they're reading it on an iPad or a Kindle, they're reading. And that means there's an appetite for stories and for books.
Well, the new book is Sword of Kings. It's the 12th entry in the Saxon Tales series. Mr. Cornwell, thank you so much for taking time to come back on the show. Can you tell people where they can find you online if they want to dig through all your back catalog and all that good stuff?
Oh, absolutely. Well, I think just Google Bernard Cornwell. You'll find me. And welcome.
Yeah, we'll put a link to your website and your Amazon page in the show notes, as well as to Sword of Kings. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Now stay tuned for an audiobook excerpt from Richard Gleaves, the Jason Crane series.
Jason ate Thanksgiving dinner alone at the Horseman restaurant. He had the place to himself. Everyone else had somewhere to be. He picked at his burger and fries, thinking of meals past. Thanksgiving had always been Eliza's favorite holiday, as Halloween had always been his. Jason glanced at the menu propped at his elbow. The horseman with his hand held high, carrying a tray with burgers and a shake. The horseman he'd seen on Halloween was no cartoon. That horseman was a thing of crematorium ash, of grave clothes and withered grass, riding a horse of autumn leaves and snail shells and pieces of skull. Jason's hand rose to the tender stripe of skin on his neck. The hatchet cut. "You okay, honey?" Jennifer, the waitress, appeared at his elbow. She had dyed her hair since he'd first met her. A pink stripe ran through the gray now, as if she had stuck her head in a cotton candy machine. "Yeah, I'm full." She raised an eyebrow. "That bad, huh?" Jason glanced at his plate, still piled with food. "Just not hungry." "You know, I saw the Headless Horseman once," said Jennifer, refreshing Jason's cup. She glanced about, deciding something. She set the pot down on a nearby table and slid into Jason's booth with some difficulty, sucking her belly in.
"I've seen him," she whispered. "Just like you."
"When?"
"Oh, 10 years ago."
Jason glanced around to see if the cooks or busboys were watching, to see if she was playing a prank. "Where?" he asked, trying to sound casual.
"East of here. Sam and I used to live out on Sawmill River Road. I worked at my daddy's Applebee's franchise, you know? It's still there. Daddy sold it, though. It was around Halloween time, and I was coming off shift. It had been a night, believe me. Parties of like 20. We sang to the little brats, 'Happy, happy birthday from all of us at Applebee's.' The horseman?"
"Right." She produced cigarettes. "Do you mind?" Jason shook his head.
"Thanks. Don't tell the smoke police."
Jason slid the saucer from beneath his coffee mug to serve as an ashtray.
"It was about midnight, probably. I counted my tips. And those little bastards stiff you, by the by. So I wasn't in a good mood. I was waiting for Sam to pick me up. I was smoking in the parking lot, trying not to catch my hair on fire, and I heard this thunder coming down the Pocantico Hills from the direction of the hollow. Rumble, rumble, rumble. But it was clear out, and the sound got closer and closer. We had a full moon that night, hanging over the top of the ridge, and I saw him come up the other side, this black shape on a horse. Fast as the devil late for church. He was down the hill before I knew it, coming right at me, and he jumped Sawmill River. Kaboom! And when he reached the parking lot, I saw."
She drew one finger across her neck.
"Nothing. No head. And it wasn't any real horse, either. Too damn fast. He was in a hurry. Didn't even see me. Whoosh! My apron blew up. The dumpster started rolling. Car alarms. Blew out my damn cigarette. He shot across the field, beeline due east. Never saw anything like it. So... She patted Jason's hand. I know you're getting laughed at. But not by me. She stubbed her cigarette in the saucer. Some of us believe you.